This is Joakim Noah of the Chicago Bulls, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Tim Gallagher, NBA historian, basketball historian, joining the Chicago Bullseye podcast. Tim, thanks again for jumping on. I'd like to start off with your opinions on Jimmy's epic performance. I mean, anytime you break a Michael Jordan record, you're doing something pretty special. Did you get a chance to watch the game, and I'd like to get your opinion on his performance and that incredible victory over Toronto.
I did see the game, Fred, and kind of good timing after our last podcast where we talked a lot about Jimmy and his journey and his leadership of the team. And I didn't see the game live, but I watched the rebroadcast of it on NBA TV. So knowing the outcome of the game made it even more fascinating because the Bulls looked like they were out of it a few times in that game. You know, on the road with, you know, being down double digits and Jimmy only scoring two in the first half, you would have never thought the outcome of the game would have ended up what it was. But I think it's kind of symbolic of how the media and some others have been so down on the Bulls without letting this breathe a little bit, right?
Exactly.
Looking at the standings today, right, January 5th, the Bulls are the second seed. And so that was an incredible second half with Jimmy and you know, taking over, you know, leadership and hitting some very, very clutch baskets. But the whole team chemistry, I thought, was really good to see. And that huddle, that excited huddle they had after the game, which was spontaneous and genuine, I thought, which just shows you that, you know, there's so much talk, like we talked about in the media, about this team, you know, Fred's lost the team and the locker room is in shambles and Rose and Butler don't get along. And gosh, it sure didn't look like that with the way those guys were huddling together after that win at Toronto. And so, you know, I thought that was very symbolic. The other thing that was interesting is hearing one of the Jimmy post-game interviews where they mentioned Jordan, and Jimmy just quickly said, "Don't compare me to him." Let's not even go there, right? Which I saw as respect to the greatest of all time, which obviously we agree on that. But what a great road win and an epic, historic performance with that second half from Jimmy.
It is kind of funny how the media is, you know, and not only that, a large percentage of the fan base that, you know, almost a week ago, they're talking about blowing up everything, the Bulls are terrible, you know, blah, blah, blah. Four games in a row later, we're the second seed. We're 7-1, I believe, against the top seven teams in the NBA, proving you can beat anyone for the most part. And, you know, suddenly things will look a lot brighter with the emergence of Portis and the team really starting to gel, it seems like. So, you know, compared to last year, this was the point where Dunleavy went out and the team basically just fell apart. I think they lost 7 and, you know, basically 4 or 5 with a couple of 20. I think today might be the anniversary or it's pretty close to it of our 20-point loss at home against Utah, which, again, to me, the bigger picture is you should never overestimate the loss of one game. You know, I think Oklahoma City lost against Sacramento at home yesterday. You know, should they blow things up? The NBA, these kind of things happen. So, big picture, things will look a little bit brighter. I'd like to get your comments on the media in general and, you know, in general how you should look at one game.
Right. Well, as I've been saying all along, it's a long season, and the Bulls roster, compared to most other rosters in the league, is a very desirable roster. So blowing that up or trading Noah, not to say there might not be some moves that are made, but, you know, even guys late in the rotation, guys like Heinrich are very reliable, trusted pros, right? And so, you know, and you saw Etuan Moore had some really key plays in that Toronto win. So to have a guy like him as your 10th or 11th man, you know, to get that kind of production out of him is hard to put a value on that. And it's a long season. Now with this little 4-game win streak and the improvement of the Bulls, you know, are they destined to win the NBA championship? I'm not going to go there yet. And we've talked about how the East is so much improved. And even recently, you've seen Brooklyn's winning some games now, Philadelphia with Jerry Colangelo kind of restoring order in the front office. They've got Mike D'Antoni on the bench and they picked up Ish Smith and they won 3 games since they picked up Ish Smith and running the point. So I don't know who had the vision of doing that, but the point is that even some of the weaker teams are now improving, and those aren't even teams we've talked about that have improved dramatically, like Charlotte and Orlando. So the East is going to be tough every night. I think listening to that NBA lockdown podcast from December 22nd, where they're saying the Bulls should blow up the roster, it's over. I just thought that was a little dramatic, and you got to kind of let these things breathe a little bit. So with that kind of perspective, I think the Bulls are making some nice progress, and for the most part, they've been in every game, even their losses, they've been competitive down to the last few minutes. There's been a few outliers, and like you mentioned, there's on any given night, when the Warriors got blown out by Dallas, right? People weren't ready to say, well, this Warrior team isn't as good as we thought, right? Or you're going to have off nights or due to injuries or just player rest. There's going to be some off nights on occasion for everybody. So, yeah, the number two seed at this stage, I think everyone would be happy with that, even those of us that kind of expected it. Right?
Well, you got three overtime losses, the Bulls. They're 0-3 in overtimes. If they could have won, one or two of those games, and Derrick Rose had shots to win those games. You really only got one that comes to mind, one game where you were completely out of it, and that was the game in Charlotte where you just got absolutely destroyed. You're going to have nights like that. But you're right, look at the last few nights. The Knicks destroy Atlanta at home in New York. And again, Oklahoma City losing pretty handily to Sacramento. There's going to be nights like that. So I don't believe in blowing up a team that's 7-1 against the top seven teams in the NBA. It's an excellent record against the teams you're going to face in the playoffs. I don't believe you should be blowing that up.
Right. Well, and I think if you take comparable teams to the Bulls in the East, and I don't know if you want to, who do you want to put in there? Miami, Atlanta. So the other, next wave of teams past Cleveland. I mean, if they would be missing people on their roster, the equivalent of Rose, Noah, and Dunleavy, 32 games into the season, I have a hard time believing they'd be 20-12, right? With dealing with those kind of injuries and gaps in their roster. And I think that speaks to the development of some of the Bulls' young players that we've talked about. Obviously McDermott, now that Portis is getting some run, we're seeing what his potential could be. So, again, considering all the factors and trying to have a calm view of this and the long view of it, I think there's a lot to be excited about with the Bulls.
I'd like to get your opinion on it. Today happens to be the anniversary of the death of Pete Maravich. And I've noticed that he's a very revered figure. I'm 42 years old. I wasn't old enough to see him play. But to the generation of fans a little bit older than me, he's an absolutely revered figure. And I had some conversations, about Steph Curry, how incredible and revolutionary he is to the game today. And a guy like LeBron James, obviously, too. I'd like to get your opinion, or for the fan base, to let us know a little bit about Pete Maravich, what made him so special, and to share with fans the story of actually his passing, which is, I think he passed today, January 5th in 1988. Is that right, 1988?
Yeah, 1988. Yes, exactly, on this date, January 5th, 1988. And so, with Pete, his name has come up recently because of the things that Curry is doing. So the fact that people haven't been talking about Maravich much, when Jason Williams, White Chocolate, that played on the Kings and Heat, when he was in his heyday of playing with Flair, obviously Maravich's name came up then. Jason Williams kind of toned his game down a little bit when he got to Miami and when they went on their championship run. He really kind of dumbed down his game, so to speak, to fit more into a more conventional offense and concept. But the flair that Steph plays with, Pete is the name that obviously comes to mind in terms of, and a lot of those things of flair were done to gain an advantage. They weren't just strictly for show, although the fact that Pete was doing this back in the day where that was considered more showboating and the game hadn't evolved where dribbling between your legs or behind the back passes or no-look passes weren't commonplace. Now, now those kind of plays are revered, and the fans love them, and they make the highlights on ESPN. At the time Pete was doing it, there was kind of a mixed reaction to it, right? A younger kid like me seeing it was, wow, this is a whole new world, a whole new way to play basketball. This is great. We'd go out and try to emulate that in our driveway pickup games, and it was fantastic. We'd only seen the Globetrotters do things like that, and now it's in mainstream games, and this guy is doing it. It was kind of like Joe Namath in the AFL type of analogy. We hadn't really seen anything quite like this guy, with his swagger and the way he went about his business on the field or on the court. So, unfortunately, Pete didn't play on teams with the talent that Curry's been playing with, right? So he's been able to kind of integrate all this flair into a great team concept. And with Pete, I think part of it was there was some resentment from his teammates on the Hawks early in his career. I think a lot of reason was financially, right? So there were some NBA veterans that, felt like they got bypassed, where, Pete got a big contract, and it wasn't a salary cap and things like they have now, right? It was a little more wide open in terms of what guys got paid and just the protocol of things. So there was, kind of a general lack of acceptance of Pete on a number of levels, despite some of the things that he did. But that said, he still led the league in scoring, had some great seasons with the Hawks and with the Jazz, and kind of fizzled out at the end of his career. He got to Boston, which that was funny. He retired, and then the year after he retired, the Celtics won the championship. So kind of the missing element of his storied career was having that NBA championship ring, and he ended up at Boston, and kind of like Jason Williams, toning down his game to more of a team concept with the Heat. Pete did that with Boston and was playing with Bird and Archibald and those guys, but I think due to injuries and just kind of his career had run its course, he ended up retiring. But yeah, there really hasn't been many like him in terms of that flair, and we talked about on a previous podcast, you said, who's the greatest shooter you've ever seen, and Curry was the name we kind of settled on because of the variety of shots that he would score on. So not only is he hitting long range bombs, and remember, Maravich, I think maybe until the last year of his career, there wasn't a 3-point line. So, think of what his numbers might have been, especially at the college level with a 3-point line. As it was, he averaged 44 a game over 3 years at LSU. So, just his, his look, his charisma, his skill level, although he was a troubled guy off the court, and I'd certainly encourage readers to research, listeners to research and read more about Pistol Pete. And in fact, there's a book by Wayne Fetterman called Maravich that I'm actually listed as one of the contributors. I helped Wayne do a little of the research for the book. So there's another one by Mark Kreigel that's a really good Maravich book too. So if any of your listeners want to really dig deep on Pistol Pete's journey, which is a fascinating one, those would be two good books to investigate.
Tim, could you talk a little bit about the day he died? I know you had an interesting story about he died playing a pickup game in Pasadena. If you could share with the listeners the little bit of the background of that day and that game.
Right. Well, after Pete's NBA career, and again, I've done a lot of research and reading about Pete, and he was a troubled soul, and then became a born-again Christian, and then with the same kind of dedication and passion he had to basketball, to mastering, spinning the ball on his finger for hours at a time, to the other, things we'd never really seen anyone do before with a basketball, he put into his faith. And so he was in Southern California for something related to that, and played an early morning pickup game. And in that pickup game were a couple of notable figures. One was a guy named Ralph Drollinger, who played at UCLA and was on Wooden's 1975 championship team, and played a little bit in the NBA, and then was also very heavily involved in Athletes in Action, which I don't know if any of the listeners are familiar with that, but a team of Christian players that would go around and play exhibition games against college teams, and they would give their testimonials and things at halftime. So Drollinger was in that game, as well as Dr. James Dobson, who's a very well-known pastor and has written numerous books and radio shows. about Christianity and faith. So those two were on the court at the time of Pete's passing. And the story goes that it was, they'd played a game, and they all felt very humbled to even be on the court with Pete. And so even at age 40, you know, although he wasn't in, you know, the shape he was as a player, was still levels above everyone else out there. And after one of the games, and again, it was kind of just a friendly pickup game, Pete said to Dr. Dobson, I feel great. You know, just was talking about how good he felt to be out on the court again. And then at the next moment, he collapsed. And at first, they thought it was a joke. He just collapsed and went down hard on the floor. And he had heart failure and passed away that day. So, and then the research, you know, autopsy showed that he had a defective heart, and that people with that kind of heart condition, you know, typically didn't live long in life in general. So the fact that Pete made it to 40 and before that had one of the more storied careers in sports history, not just basketball history, is kind of amazing. So fascinating guy and life, Pistol Pete.
Could you talk a little bit about the passing of Meadowlark Lemon, and just unfortunately left us? He, you know, obviously a legendary figure with the Harlem Globetrotters. Maybe talk a little bit about Meadowlark and then also the Harlem Globetrotters for those listeners who may not be aware of, you know, what they were and how important they are in basketball history.
Sure. Well, Meadowlark Lemon was certainly one of the cornerstones of the Globetrotter brand, and again, that's something you might want to YouTube or look at, but he would be the guy in the high post. They'd throw the ball to him, and he'd go through all kind of antics and tuck the ball under his shirt. But, you know, had skill level, though, to back up some of the antics that he would do. But, you know, certainly, you know, one of the clown princes of basketball, Meadowlark Lemon, and the Globetrotters, you know, again, before the NBA really integrated, you know, it's kind of a good segue to talk about Pistol Pete, because he was kind of, joked as the white Globetrotter, right? Because he did things that only the Globetrotters had done previously in terms of some of the fancy things and, you know, I guess what would be called showboating. And that was somewhat frowned upon in the earlier days of the NBA just because of, you know, people looked at it not as a showcase of someone's skills, but more of you're showing up an opponent or disrespecting an opponent. That was the mindset early on. So the Globetrotters were kind of the venue for more fun basketball and more spectacular and, making the game more fun, I guess you'd say. And obviously the product we have on the court today is kind of the merging of all of that, and the game that we've been loving for decades now is kind of a blend of the Globetrotter flair and athleticism with, you know, again, the more structured and, old school way to play basketball. So Meadowlark Lemon, Curly Neal, and then, you know, the generation before them on the Globetrotters, people like Deuce Tatum and Marcus Haynes actually just passed away as well. Marcus Haynes was the, you know, arguably the greatest dribbler of all time, predecessor to Curly Neal, who was an unbelievable ball handler as well. But again, things now that Steph Curry does in games, right, where these guys would do it in some little segment of a Globetrotter game. And the Globetrotters, for the listeners who don't know, they would play a team called the Washington Generals, which were basically a team designated to lose. And so they were kind of the fodder for the Globetrotters to kind of a mix of, you know, straight basketball with all the trickery. But, you know, it was comprised of former college players and players that were at least competent, but obviously they were set up to get beat by the Globetrotters every night. So, an interesting slice of basketball history and with Meadowlark passing away.
You know, I wanted to continue a conversation from last week, too. Some players that we discussed, comparable to Jimmy Butler, who, you know, kind of maxed out at the NBA level, who really kind of became quote-unquote stars at the NBA level. Couple of listeners gave us some interesting suggestions. I'd like to go over some of those and talk a bit about those players specifically.
Sure. The basic theme, and there's a lot of angles to it, but what we were thinking of, someone that was just, you know, a good college player but became a great NBA player, right? So more unsung in college and became an all-star or great in the pros. And obviously Jimmy Butler is one of those guys, and not to disrespect what he did at Marquette, but he's at a whole nother level now, and I think he would be the first to admit that. But one of the listeners also noted Eric Bledsoe, who played at Kentucky, and obviously Kentucky's had waves and waves of great players over the years, and a lot of them one-and-done type players. And Bledsoe, while solid at Kentucky, wasn't a star on the team, and until his recent knee injury, has had some very impressive seasons with Phoenix. Another listener went back at more old school, and we also noted some of those names as well, players like John Starks and Latrell Sprewell, Mark Eaton, Dennis Johnson. But a listener came up with one that I thought was fantastic, which was Bill Laimbeer, who obviously is much hated among Bulls fans because they'll remember him from the bad boy Piston teams. But Bill was a Notre Dame player, but I went back and looked, and in terms of minutes and contribution on the Notre Dame teams, he was fourth or fifth best player on his college team. So the fact that he went on to NBA stardom and multi-time All-Star, multi-NBA champion with the Pistons, no one would have really seen that in terms of Laimbeer's potential from his college playing days. So that was a great suggestion and one I hadn't really thought of, but definitely fits the description.
I do want to talk a little bit about the Phoenix Suns and the disintegration of a team that was really a great story last year. What is going on there? I mean, they recently fired their assistants. Jeff Hornacek still has a job. I remember very few situations where a head coach was not fired and just the assistants were fired. What has happened in Phoenix, and what do you think the major issues are there, outside, obviously, of Bledsoe's injury?
Right. Well, yeah, and that all happened before Bledsoe got injured, but things definitely were off track. And I think tying this back to the Bulls and some of these other teams, what is really realistic in terms of expectations for the Suns and their roster and competing in the West? Obviously, they had a pretty good season last year, but still didn't make the playoffs. Jeff Hornacek is obviously a well-respected person, not just a coach, but from his playing days and his personality in the league. And so it was a little bit unusual that they fired a few assistants, especially at this point of the season, and kept the head coach around. Interestingly enough, one of the Morris twins threw a towel at Hornacek, several weeks before this all came down. And in an odd way, I think the fact that he threw that towel at Hornacek ended up helping Hornacek keep his job, because I think it would have sent a bad message from management if they would have fired Hornacek after a player disrespecting him like that. So in an odd way, I think that helped them keep Hornacek as the head coach. And just on a related note, here in San Diego, they kept the Chargers coach Mike McCoy, but fired six of the assistants. So I guess maybe this is a new trend in coaching overall. You don't see it happen as often that way. And I was thinking, Monty Williams seemed like such a good fit with the Pelicans and as a mentor for Anthony Davis. And I was thinking that might have been a better path for the Pelicans, was to maybe make some other changes with the staff, but keep Monty Williams on as the coach. Now he's an assistant with the Thunder, and Alvin Gentry, of course, is at New Orleans. And, things, from my view, and I know there's been injuries and other reasons, but the Pelicans are definitely not in a better spot than they were last year for a number of reasons. So, some interesting dynamics there. And I think there are bigger issues overall in Phoenix with their roster and in the front office. I think out of respect to Hornacek and the timing of some of those other events, it worked to their advantage, but, I saw them play the Lakers the other night and the Lakers blew them out. So, this is not a strong Lakers team, and Phoenix was way, way behind. To their credit, they did continue to compete and made somewhat of a game of it, but, that roster is definitely not playoff bound, and I'm not sure if there's any quick fix for the Suns.
So, Tim, we got the Bulls are playing the Bucks, and to wrap up the show, I really appreciate you again joining. I'd like to get your opinion on what is wrong with the Bucks. I mean, that was a big surprise last year how good they were. And you know, they had a really good, nice run. They made the playoffs, gave the Bulls a little bit of problems, taking us to six games at the end of round one. And this year they seem to just, you know, fallen off the table again, just been terrible. What do you see with that team that needs improvement? And overall, what do you think their outlook is for the future?
Right, they definitely have seemed to have taken a step back. And, you know, and I'm always one that thinks of those glue guys that maybe on the surface don't seem like, you know, if they lose that guy from their roster, it's going to make that big of a difference on their team. But a guy that I'm pretty familiar with because he grew up here in San Diego is Jared Dudley. And while he wasn't a star on the Bucks, you know, he's one of those glue guys and chemistry guys. And I'm not saying the Bucks' demise compared to what their potential was for this year was just for not re-signing Jared Dudley. He's on the Wizards now. But, you know, it's interesting how little things like that do impact the team. The other thing, last year when they kind of made their run, Jabari Parker was not playing, right? He had his knee injury. And now he's back, and they're integrating him back in the lineup. I know Jason Kidd has had some health issues, so he's not on the bench right now. So it seems like almost everything that could go wrong with them has gone wrong. But, again, they're still a dangerous team, you know, in terms of the Greek Freak could go off, and I still like his potential and what I see from him. They've got some long athletic guys like Michael Carter-Williams and John Henson. You saw they gave the Bulls a real handful in the playoffs last year when no one was really expecting that. So, again, even though they're at the bottom of the division, and obviously you could argue that the Central Division is the best division in the league, you know, from top to bottom. You know, there's some others that would be in the discussion. So I still think Milwaukee's a dangerous team, but I would say while they're down, the Bulls should take advantage of that and make sure they take care of business.
Tim, thanks again for coming on. I'm just here, but I really appreciate joining the Bullseye and look forward to having you on again soon.
Sounds great, Fred. We'll talk again soon.